So yes, we're going to explore this lecture, this classic lecture that Sanghrajita gave in 1969, I believe, called Breaking Through into Buddhahood. He gave it on the anniversary of the founding of the order and movement. The movement had been going, what's now called the Triratna Buddhist Community, had been going 2 years, and the order had been going 1 year. And he gave it, I believe he gave it at the Buddhist Society in Eccleston Square in Victoria. I'm not completely sure of that, but I think that's where he gave it. But yes, it was 1969. And some of the lecture, in a way, is of its time. But the points that he, maybe how he puts things is of its time. But the points that he makes are as fresh and relevant as they ever were. It's well worth exploring. And I'm not going to be able to really do it justice in the time that we've got this evening. So I just really recommend that you, if you are interested, that you look on Free Buddhist Audio, where you can listen to the lecture or download a PDF copy of it and read it. But Bhante is, how I'm going to refer to Sanghrajita, Bhante is a term of respect, traditional term of respect for your teacher. He begins the lecture by saying that this movement that he's founded is a sort of breakthrough in itself. It's a sort of breakthrough in itself. A breakthrough not into Buddhahood, he says that would be going too far, but it's a breakthrough in terms of Western Buddhism as it was at that time. What he does is he sort of talks about Western Buddhism as it is in 1969. And he says the earliest Buddhist movement in Britain was in Shropshire, he thinks. And in 1923, you had the Shropshire Buddhist Society. I think in the 60s it was still going. But what he says is that although Buddhism in the West has been studied for a number of decades, and people have been reading the suttas and the sutras and exploring the philosophy and the teachings, although they've been doing that, he says there's been something very much that's been missing. And he says that what people were doing was that they were trying to practice Buddhism. Although they were trying to practice Buddhism, they were only doing it to a certain extent. And it was to the extent that it did not, and I'm quoting, that it did not interfere with the living of a respectable, usually rather middle-class, conventional English lifestyle. In other words, in those days, one, as it were, prided oneself, even if one was a Buddhist, on being just like everybody else. So he's talking in 1969 a little bit about the past, but he's also being sort of critical about the state of Buddhism as he found it when he came back to the West. He said that people were interested in sort of the theory, but they sort of carried on living exactly as they would have done had Buddhism never touched their lives at all. So they had the same jobs, the same houses and possessions and pastimes and leisure activities. They ate the same food, they did the same things, but once a week or once whenever, they'd go and listen to a lecture on Buddhism. Of course, things have changed, haven't they, for us, hopefully, to some degree. What he's saying is that he's founded this new Buddhist movement to, in a way, be a different form of Buddhist practice in the West. And of course, since that founding of the Triratna Buddhist Community, there have been lots of other Buddhist movements that have also been founded in the West, and fortunately Buddhism's in a healthier state now in England and Britain than it was, you know, in 1969. At least that's what I think. I'm sure it is, actually. So, what he says is that if you're practicing Buddhism, it should make a difference. He quotes William James as saying, a difference must make a difference. So if you're practicing Buddhism and you're trying to do something different, then it must make a difference in your life. A difference must make a difference. A difference cannot just be theoretical. So he says, more and more people now understand that the Buddha's teaching, little by little, should transform one's whole existence, individual and collective. That, if one is a Buddhist, if one understands Buddhism, if one is trying to put it into practice, then it should affect every aspect of one's life. It should affect the kind of work that one does, how one is employed, how one earns money, how one does one's work, the way in which one does it. It should affect also in the way in which one makes use of one's leisure time, he says. It should affect one's attitudes towards such major aspects of human life as, for example, marriage, the family, sex, social life, and so on. And if one happens to be, say, a writer, he says, or an artist, then it should deeply influence one's creative work and one's creative output, not just, as it were, from the outside, but deeply from within. He goes on to talk about even the food and the clothes, the food one eats and the clothes one wears. I don't know what he means by clothes one wears. As far as I know, in the Theravada Buddhist community, we just wear what everybody else sort of wears. Unless an order member has become taken vows of celibacy, and then they sometimes wear robes, but that's not even then very often. So I just want to pause there and see if this strikes you as relevant. Does it strike you as challenging, relevant? Does it make sense? And in a way, you could just sort of ask yourself, perhaps, has your practice of Buddhism, since you came across the Dharma, has it touched other aspects of your life, apart from, say, coming to a Buddhist centre, the Buddhist centre, once a week, or however often that you come? So I'd just be interested in exploring, for the next two or three few minutes, maybe 5 minutes, and then we'll have a cup of tea, what you make of this, a difference should make a difference.
I think it's still a dilemma, probably.
Yeah.
I don't wish to appear weird, you know, to my friends, but I do, you know, want to live in a more moral way than... I mean, I guess I found a kind of key to, you know, trying to put some ideals about how to live into practice. But I'd always sort of, on the side of not appearing to be weird if I could get away with it. Or
yeah.
Say, oh, well, you know, you wouldn't want to hear about that or,
yeah.
You know, something.
Yeah, yeah. So not wanting to sort of stand out.
Really, the kind of dilemma is always with us, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Can other people relate to that tension? It's more like a tension of, well, wanting to, in a way, practice what you said in a more... Well, put the moral principles into action in your life, but also not wanting to stand out, or feeling the discomfort of standing out. Yeah, Jim.
It makes sense to me, because to me it's about being authentic.
Yeah.
So it's if like actually finding out who you are, and obviously the dilemma then is that essentially we are not all the same.
Yeah.
So I think you get to a point where you have to make the decision whether you actually really want to go with it, and if you believe in it, then sort of inevitably it will have to change your life.
Yeah.
So there's no way around it.
Yeah.
Or so if you're really doing it on a way too superficial level.
Yeah.
Which means that you'll never get to the truth, and obviously if if you've gotten that far, it is what you want. So I think there's a crucial point that you you reach.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say you'd have to change your life, and I kind of know what you mean, but I kind of want to also clarify that Buddhism would it doesn't sort of believe in coercion or pressure from without. So it would be quite an un-Buddhist spirit for me or somebody to say you have to change your life in a certain sense. But what Buddhism does do is give you practices which, if you take seriously, then you start to change. And then the compulsion to change your life comes from within. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't come without some tensions. But it's a natural unfolding kind of compulsion that says, no, I want to live differently. Does that make sense to you?
I wonder though,
Go on.
No, but I wonder I wasn't sure that your statement was, or the quote, or whatever it was quite fair about historically people may have led quite privileged, middle-class, white lifestyles, and that perhaps they weren't really doing Buddhism. So I bet there are some people that may have taken it quite seriously. And to me that sounds like a bit of a them and us. And I think sometimes the challenge can be to... because it implies, first of all, that those people are not living a good life or don't have work that's meaningful and ethical and so on. It's not the case. I work with many people who actually probably more ethical and thoughtful about the work than I am, and they're not Buddhists. And so I don't know that it's... I struggle when it gets divided up like that, because I think there are lots of people with other faiths, without faith, that may live, that really may live according to certain moral principles that are better. It might be Buddhism, but... And I'm not saying you're saying that, but I think there's a danger in thinking if you take on certain so-called Buddhist cultural things, like being a vegetarian, that somehow will make you a better person. It might not. You might be doing it for the wrong reason. Yeah. You might be doing it because it's cool, or because you want people to think you're a bit special.
I don't think that's quite what Bhante's saying, though. Do you think that's what he's saying?
No, I don't think that he is, but it can sound a bit.
But I think what he's saying is quite different. I think what he's saying is not necessarily a judgment that somebody practicing Buddhism is better. And for a start, he's not referring to now anyway. He's referring to the state of Buddhism in the 60s. I think what he's saying is that people were practicing Buddhism without changing their life. What he's saying is that if you're genuinely practicing Buddhism, then it should change your life. That doesn't mean that some people who are not practicing Buddhism might not be leading a better life anyway. But if you just take an individual, then they should be changing, wherever they're starting from. Buddhism should be about change in one's life. And if it isn't, then it's remaining an abstract, rather theoretical interest. That then isn't genuine Dharma. That's what he's saying. So he's not comparing a non-Buddhist with a Buddhist, do you see what I mean? Or saying one is better than the other. He's just saying, if you're genuinely practicing, then you should be changing that. One of the things, I think, at the time, was that people... meditation wasn't that widely practiced, even in Buddhist circles. And I think if it had been more practiced, puja wasn't practiced, if it had been more practiced, then people would naturally have started to change. But Buddhism at the time was rather an academic affair. That's what he was referring to. And it probably was an academic affair amongst the middle classes. Sorry, you had a question first.
Thinking of your question, which is, has Buddhism changed my life?
Yeah.
And it has, and it hasn't.
Yeah, me too. Can you say more?
Yeah, and for now I have another question for you. It's changed maybe the quality of my life.
Yeah.
Or my interactions with people, but
yeah.
My friends before Buddhism are all still my friends now.
Yeah.
My work or my interests before Buddhism and values, I suppose, are the same, but the how I try and approach it now is different.
Yeah.
But the quality is different.
Yeah.
Not always, but
yeah. Yeah. And I think that's really valid, isn't it? And important. I think it would be wrong to take this too literally, as to say that you know it meant that we all had to leave our jobs or do something, you know, leave our families or do something very, very different. For a start, as you were saying, Debbie, a lot of people are living a very ethical life anyway, and holding ethical values. So when they encounter Buddhism, a lot of people say, ah, yes, it's articulating what I was already trying to do with my life. It doesn't feel so foreign for a lot of people. And your work is sort of right livelihood, in that it's ethical, it's working for creating community, etc., etc.
But also it's made huge changes.
Yeah.
At the same time.
Yeah.
And there's this quote that I'm probably going to misquote now, but it was in my head when you started talking, which is something like, before enlightenment, I carried food and water and farmed the animals or something, and then after enlightenment, I carried food and water, and it's like the same. You do the same things before and after.
But with a very different mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's right, and I think where in a way it starts to perhaps force us to change is where the ethical values become come into conflict with how we were. And then that can be more of a source of friction or tension even. But if, you know, to the extent that we're living a life that's already in line with Buddhist ethical principles, you can practice very successfully within that life. Look, let's have a cup of tea. And then we can carry on exploring more. There's loads more to explore after tea. Thank you. Okay, you ready for more? So, we were talking about a difference making a difference, or at least that's what Banti was talking about. And what he then goes on to say is that, in a word, Buddhism is revolutionary, and I really like that, in that it goes against a popular misconception of Buddhism as being somehow, somehow just sort of navel-gazing and escaping from life, and escaping from engagement. Actually, what he's saying is that Buddhism should cause a revolution internally, and then that manifests externally in your life and in your relationships and in a desire to change the world around you, within whatever sphere of influence we have, to alleviate suffering. So there's a sort of strong, energetic, you could say heroic, aspect to the Dharma, without which it really isn't Buddhism. It's not Buddhism. All the meditation, all the practice, this is me speaking, but all the meditation, all the practice, all the retreats that we go on are so that we can effect a revolution internally and in the world at large, at least to whatever degree we can. But I'm going to move on, because there's more to explore. What Sendra actually goes on to talk about is this notion of breaking through. So he says that usually or often we think of the spiritual life in terms of growth, in terms of gradually developing greater awareness, greater kindness, greater contentment, greater energy, greater creativity, greater freedom, greater fearlessness or courage, all of those things. And that's a good way of thinking about the Buddhist path. It's an unfoldment, a growth towards more that is in our own potential, towards more life, you could say. That's a good way of thinking about it. But it's not the only way of thinking about the Buddhist path. And what Bhante goes on to say is that sometimes there are abrupt transitions in one's spiritual life that are more like breakthroughs, not just gradual sort of incremental growth, but an abrupt breakthrough to a new level of awareness, to a new level of being. And it's the breakthroughs that he wants to talk about, and what does breaking through mean, and what are we trying to break through anyway. He goes on to say that you could say that in an average Buddhist life, in an average spiritual practice, average spiritual life, you have periods where it's any kind of growth is gradual and incremental, and in fact sometimes imperceptible. Sometimes you have to look back after a couple of years or 3 years or 4 years to notice, ah yes, I have become a little bit less reactive. I have become a little bit more content. I am able to respond creatively a little bit more in situations where I would have reacted and flipped or not coped. So a lot of the time it's like that. Then you get these transitional breakthrough moments, and then you carry on incrementally, and then another breakthrough might arise at some point. And there might be years between those breakthroughs, or it might be more rapid than that. And the breakthroughs can be more or less dramatic. But that's how he talks about the average kind of spiritual life. But it's the breakthroughs that we're going to look at. And he looks at it in three ways. He says, we're going to look at what does one try and break through, or what one does break through, how one breaks through, and where and when one breaks through. Actually, he gives less and less time in the lecture as the questions go on. So the where and when he doesn't give that much time to, and he doesn't give that much time to the how. But there's quite a lot to say about the what. So we're going to look at the what first. What he says is that, well, in a sense it's very straightforward to answer. What you're trying to break through is you're trying to break through all of samsaric existence. Everything that's conditioned, everything that's mundane, everything that's not enlightenment, you're trying to see through, break through. Yeah? You're trying to transcend. But that is a broad kind of, well, huge, infinite, broad kind of category. And he wants to look more specifically at aspects of samsaric life that you break through. So he chooses four significant ones. So I'm going to tell you what the four are that he looks at, and then we'll look at them in more detail, and we'll talk about how as well. Okay. So the four are, first of all, negative emotions. So you break through negative emotions. And we'll look at what he means by that. The second is that you break through psychological conditioning. You break through psychological conditioning. The third is that you break through the rational mind and rational thinking. And the fourth is that you break through your sense of time. So they get more and more so radical and mysterious. You break through, he calls it time sense. You break through time sense. So negative emotion, psychological conditioning, rational thinking, and then your sense of time. And in each one, we'll explore how we might do that. And then lastly, he talks about where and when that's likely to happen most easily. So shall we look at negative emotion first? So negative emotion, he talks about how the Buddhist tradition talks about three primary kind of negative emotions. There's neurotic desire, sort of craving that's neurotic desire. There's hatred, and there's fear.
What does neurotic mean?
In this context, that's a good point. So what do you think? What would be neurotic desire as opposed to a non-neurotic desire?
Well, I mean, you didn't really want what you desired.
Yeah. I think that's on the right track. That is on the right track. It's like you... Well, let's see if anybody else has a thought.
I think in this context, and in many contexts, a neurosis is a inadequate response to what is without, and it's the way. So another word for it, or a relevant way of thinking about it, might be mimetic. It's copied. It doesn't come from within, but it's a desire which you've acquired, you've picked up, a bit like an infection is the analogy.
Interesting, yeah. So something not genuine.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's an interesting way of looking at it.
Based on anxiety.
Imitated. Based on anxiety.
Yeah.
Can you say more, Debbie?
Well, that's what I think. What neurosis means, from a therapeutic point of view, neurosis is where you've got an anxiety that's based on some absence of something you perceive that you need.
Right.
And then you channel a desire towards trying to reduce your anxiety.
It doesn't really work.
So, like shopping, if you're lonely.
Exactly. So, I think that's what he's getting at as well. That there might be a sort of human need there. That's a very understandable need, like loneliness, needing a companionship, a relationship, needing connection. But trying to meet that need in a way that will never satisfy that need, sort of trying to avoid our experience through shopping, through chocolate, immediate gratification, whatever it is. And of course, the immediate gratification does have an effect. It's not that there isn't any gratification, but it doesn't actually meet the need. So it leaves you feeling more frustrated and hollow, probably. Leaves us feeling more. And we all do that, don't we? We all try and sort of, we're experiencing whatever it is, loneliness, sadness, wanting love, and we reach for whatever it is, you know. Toast or as if that's going to meet that need for love.
So you could say misdirected instead.
It's misdirected, yeah, it's misdirected.
Desire a person.
Yeah.
Or you could think you desire another person. It's in fact because you're dissatisfied with yourself.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe there are levels and levels of how misdirected it can be. And more or less damaging ways in which we try and meet it. You know, toast might not be such a damaging way. It depends how much you eat. But we can all think of much more harmful ways in which we try and fulfill what are emotional needs in a material, chemical way.
So that's, you say that it's also a reaction, that it's reactionary.
Yeah, it's reactionary.
You know, you reach for whatever it is.
Yeah, that's with a hand.
This idea of mimetic, like a copying, like children copy without thinking what they're doing.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
This idea that you don't think, oh, I need love.
Yeah.
So I'm going, you know, you don't have that consciousness.
Yeah.
You just buy something.
Yeah.
Or eat something or
yeah.
drink something and then... Perhaps
yeah.
you might reflect on that.
Yeah.
But then it's always a little bit too late.
Yeah. So that's right. It's a reaction. It's a reaction. And I think that's interesting that we learn those reactions often from other people and the world around us. We're very, very socially conditioned, aren't we? And social conditioning around us generally will tell us to, well, it will offer us solutions like shopping for achieving happiness. All around we'll be getting those signals in subtle and not so subtle ways. Yeah, so it's reactive, it's not very individual. We probably don't pause long enough to actually say, what do I need? Let alone try and address that need in a genuine way. Yeah. Whereas it is, so Buddhism's not saying that all desires sort of going to be unhealthy. There are healthy desires, particularly a need for human, well, there are those survival kind of needs, like enough food and shelter, and, you know, to have a reasonably comfortable kind of life, so you're not hungry and thirsty. So there's survival needs. But above that, there are also healthy needs like feeling connected, feeling loved, feeling that you're living a worthwhile life, feeling that there's some sort of meaning, etc., etc. And it's those needs that often we don't really take seriously or don't address in a healthy way. And it leads to all sorts of psychological pain, as well as sort of spiritual stagnation.
Connected to fear.
Fear, yeah.
Yeah, so kind of a desire for this thing that if I don't get, I'm afraid this other thing will happen.
Yeah, yes, I think fear must drive us a lot of the time. Can you think of an example of?
Like if I don't get a job, I will never get a job.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And then I'll be homeless, and then and my life will fall apart, etc., etc. Yeah. So often our instincts are driven by, well, anxiety, as you're saying, Debbie, or fear. Fear is a stronger form of that, where we're trying to avoid some sort of imagined happening. Now, that's not to say that all fears are completely unjustified. You know, there might be grains of truth in them, but often we blow them out of all proportion, and they become, again, they're sort of neurotic. They're not grounded in objective reasoning and fact, actually. And then somewhere along the line, as we go deeper, and you it's as well, meditation allows you to explore this more deeply, but therapy would as well, and other forms of introspection will take you there. You encounter perhaps deeper and deeper levels of not more fear, but necessarily you go deeper into what fears drive us, and ultimately there's a fear of death, isn't there? That all of us somewhere must harbour, a fear of annihilation, a fear of non-existence. Again, it's to a lesser or greater extent in each individual, but somewhere we kind of must fear that.
Are you saying that kind of drives all the other drives?
I don't know, to be honest, but I think it's a very deep one. I think it's a very deep one. I don't know if it drives everything, but it's one that we tend to have so deeply that we don't even consciously look at a lot of the time. Unless we're confronted with it directly. And life does confront us with it at some point or other. So let me read you what he says. So there are three... yes, there are these three primary forms of negative emotions. So that's the neurotic desire, the hatred, and the fear. And then he says, but there are many, very many secondary and tertiary forms. And then he just lists this horrible list. He says there's anxiety, a sort of diffused fear. There's insecurity. There's jealousy. There's self-pity, guilt, contempt, conceit, envy, depression, pessimism, gloom, alarm, despondency, despair, suspicion, resentment, .. And, you know, that sorry? So, there's lots of variations, as he calls them, secondary or tertiary forms of these negative emotions, these primary negative emotions. He says he doesn't want to talk too much about them, because almost dwelling too much on them can trigger the very emotions that you're trying to transcend, you know, or transform. But what he does say is that all negative emotions represent a drainage or leakage of emotional energy. What they do is they take away our life energy, if you like. They drain us, and they make us more constricted and narrow in our emotional world. And they tend to, therefore, isolate us from other people and the world around us. And we become more and more enclosed within our own prison created by them. Again, it's always a question of degree. But do we recognise what that feels like? It feels very real, even though we're talking in metaphors. It feels very real. That's what negative emotions do. If we, you know, persist in them. So what do we do to transform them, to break through into, well, a positive emotional life, a positive emotional world? What would we do? What can we do?
I think the first thing is to recognise that you're doing it.
Right, yeah.
The first
yeah,
say,
yeah.
I am in that world.
Exactly.
You know, the guinea pig in a cage, mm. Round and round with that sort of negative thought.
Yeah.
And then I guess the next stage is to actually have a counterpart to it.
Yeah.
That's positive.
Yeah.
And keep reinforcing it.
Yeah.
It's not watching the guinea pig wheel and the elder the guinea pig on the house for the sake of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then. I mean, this is really simplistic, isn't it? But then trying to find a counteraction to that.
Yeah.
A counterbalance of a positive emotion or a positive action.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's not just a negative thought, it's a negative physical action you're doing in the world.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that summarises it really well. There's first of all recognition, acknowledgement that I am in a state that's unhelpful, an emotional state that's unhelpful, a negative emotional state. And with alongside that recognition and acknowledgement, for it to be really acknowledged, I have to acknowledge that it's my responsibility to do something about it. Because it's easy sometimes to acknowledge that, oh yes, I'm in a state of hatred and anger. But then the very next thing is to blame that on the world, the situation, other people, etc., etc., isn't it? That's a very common, easy, tempting avenue to go down, and it leads nowhere. In the end, it leads nowhere. It's a cul-de-sac, it's a dead end, and what it does is just reinforce our negativity. So alongside that acknowledgement, there's got to be a sense that, okay, whatever the external conditions might have been to trigger this, nevertheless, I'm responsible for the state of my mind. Really, really difficult, really hard, but profound and really, really important. And then, on the back of that, we can then look at positive counterparts to transform that. And as you say, those positive counterparts might be working sort of directly on the mind, or it might be working, well, doing some positive actions and then having a secondary kind of effect on the mind, then having.
Yeah, it's just that kind of simple thing of, you know, you do something, you get an instant response.
Yeah.
And then you change what you do, a positive attitude, and put it in the world and see the response you get back from it.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right.
In your own mind, you can actually see that the people or the situations are changing.
Yeah.
The fluidity of how you can move it from negative to positive.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's right. Positive actions. Actions can really... Actions that take us out of ourselves, so just being a little bit friendly or kind or generous can have a big effect. on our own emotional world. I mean, I've just come back from 3 weeks away, and there seems to be, at least in my experience, and it might not be everybody's experience, a really kind of positive feeling with the Olympics at the moment. And I was in Victoria Park last night with some friends, watching things on the big screen, and it was a very, very positive atmosphere in Victoria Park, which felt like everybody in that situation was a little bit more positive than they normally might be. And the effect of several thousand people all being a little bit more positive than they might otherwise be was tangible. Really, really tangible. Just the friendliness and the banter that was going on between people and the celebration of the athletes. Sort of regardless of what, I mean, obviously, when it was somebody from Britain, you know, everybody, the roar was louder, but sort of regardless of who it was, people were just celebrating excellence and heroism and achievement and dedication in a very human and rather sort of innocent way. Delightful, delightful. I really recommend... Well, you're here tonight, and I'm glad you're here tonight, but when you're not here, I really recommend you go to Victoria Park and watch something on the big screen, just for the atmosphere. So you can do it. We can kind of generate. We affect each other, and we can generate just by simple actions. Yeah, just by simple actions, actually. You know, so we were sitting there, there's a group of about eight of us, and one of us wanted to take a picture, and he got up and took a picture, and then handed me the camera and said, would I take a picture with him in it? And, you know, this man who's sitting just a little way away had seen that, and he said, no, look, you all get together, I'll take your picture. Just a very simple action from a stranger, and all of those add up. So actions. But also working directly on the mind. What else might we do to transform negative emotion? Yeah.
I find it really helpful not to identify with it.
Yes.
When we were talking about this in the break, sort of you could just go like, well, I have depression, I'm depressed, therefore obviously it's natural that I'm lying, I don't do anything about it. Instead you go, well, it's just my mind, it's something I'm experiencing.
Yeah.
But it's not all of me, it's not all there is to me.
Yeah. And that's key in mindfulness. That's one of the key aspects of mindfulness, isn't it? That we have a sort of positive distance from the experience, from the thoughts, from the feelings. There's something of a positive disassociation where we can look at our experience as it were from outside the experience, and that gives us a sense of freedom, and then a sense of being able to do something about it. We're not lost in it, we're not drowned in it. So yes, a sort of positive disidentification is a key aspect of mindfulness, and helps you acknowledge. Hi.
I think it's difficult when you're in the outside world, but when you experience something, a negative reaction, to really be able to pause and for a few seconds and think about what you're going to say or what you're going to do, and what you, because so often I see myself, I say something, I do something, and then 2 minutes later, I really didn't want to eat that or I shouldn't have said that.
Being
able to just really pause and think about what you're about to do.
And again, mindfulness does this, doesn't it? So as well as providing a positive disassociation from the actual experience, what that gap does is it gives us a pause enough to think about, do we want to say this, act in this way, etc. It gives us a bit more freedom of choice because there's this pause, as you say. That is the pause that Subhadramati and others have been exploring in the spiral path on the Wheel of Life. There's the gap between feeling and craving, and we can experience the feeling and not automatically, at least at our best, not automatically react in the way that we normally do. So mindfulness, all of that is part of mindfulness. Yeah.
This might have more or less been touched on, but reflecting on just how changeable it all is can help as well. A sort of positivity and recognising, when I have presence of mind doing this, which I don't always manage, but if I'm feeling, a sharp, like today for instance, just because I'm tired, I had some quite sort of sharp highs and lows.
Sure.
But if I can recognise all of those as quite sort of, as not like, it's not sort of totally meaningful about the world,
that's right.
but rather temporary elements of my state of mind, then that realisation has taken a while, but has become in itself a sort of kind of steady positivity.
Yes, that's right. And it leads to a sort of more equanimous state, where the highs and lows can still happen, but we're not thrown by them in the same way, because there's a bigger, broader perspective that contains them. That says, yes, okay, this is great, or this is awful, and it's, as you say, temporary, and it isn't the whole of life, and it's not even probably the whole of my experience even now. It's temporary and it's partial. One of the things elsewhere Sangharakshita talks about is how the unenlightened mind makes illegitimate generalizations from current experience. That's what we all do. So we take our present experience and there's some psychological or physical pain, and we illegitimately generalise from it and say that this is the whole of life forever, the whole of my life, the whole of my world. And when you put it like that, it's a very childish way of being, isn't it? Within a child, that's very... understandable. In a four-year-old, if they fall over and scratch their knees, in a way that is their world, and you can sort of think, oh yeah, fair enough. But you know then how a child, then you give them an ice cream and the world is suddenly completely bright and radiant, and that's their world. You can sort of manage and even manipulate that probably in a child. But somewhere, although we've become more sophisticated, we still do that sort of illegitimate generalisation very easily. A lot of the time, we lose this broader perspective. And all unenlightened beings are somehow doing that. Somehow we haven't got a broad enough perspective on things. Yeah.
We're always creating meaning up here.
Yeah.
Our brains are like machines.
Yeah.
The creation of
meaning.
Hard to work with actually.
That's very hard. Yeah. We really do think that my experience right now is the most important thing that's happening in the universe.
We think it is the world.
That's right. And Buddhism's everywhere trying to take us out into a broader perspective. It's saying, look, this self-centered perspective is not only wrong, it's just not true, but it's painful and limiting. I mean, this whole perspective of lifetimes, whether you take it as legitimate, as literally true or not, I tend to believe in the Buddhist teaching of rebirth, although probably not strongly enough. But if I really could imagine loads and loads of lifetimes, then perhaps this lifetime and whether I achieve all my aims in this lifetime wouldn't be such a serious matter. Do you know what I mean? There's a certain sense in which that would broaden my perspective even more. So yes, perspective, not taking the current experience as the whole, not generalising in an illegitimate way, in an irrational way, acknowledgement, mindfulness that creates a gap, a positive gap, a disassociation and a sense of being able to choose a different response, then choosing more creative responses that will generate more emotional positivity. And then there are straightforward methods like meditation. I say straightforward in that, not because meditation is straightforward, but it's directly working on your mind. Yeah? Cultivating metta, cultivating mindfulness. All of those are tools for transforming this emotional world. Yeah. Not the only ones. Bhante talks about environment. He says, you know, go out into open spaces, into nature, into sunshine. Easier said than done sometimes. Friendship. Be around people who are more emotionally positive. It rubs off. It's hard to be grumpy when somebody around you is not. Do you know what I mean? Well, sometimes it makes you even more grumpy. but generally, if you associate with people who are more emotionally positive, that will have a positive effect on you. So look at who do we spend time with, how do we spend time. When you do have time with your friends, what do you gravitate in terms of, where does your conversation gravitate? It's so easy to gravitate towards complaining and sharing woes and miseries, etc. When you're just picking up a newspaper, you know, what are you taking in? So often the media just exploits that neurotic desire, that hatred, that fear, by feeding it. Yeah. So what are you letting in to your mind? There are all sorts of ways that we can look at the world and be a bit more intelligent about what we do with it, what we do with our time and our energy. But I'm going to move on. Psychological conditionings is the next one that we're trying. Next thing that we're trying to break through from. So what do you think Bhante means here by psychological conditioning?
Schemata that we've adopted,
yeah.
Like the concepts that we have of how the world and our interactions work.
Yeah. So can you give me examples?
Well, the examples that I give are usually quite dysfunctional, but so let's say someone grows up in an environment where sort of like every time they speak, like someone shouting at them.
Yeah.
They will learn, oh, I better be quiet and I don't say anything in the face of injustice. So they train their character to sort of be passive if they see injustice in the world.
Yeah.
Because that's what they've learned.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So psychological conditioning through, I don't know, childhood experiences, etc. Mm-hmm. That's right. And some of that might be quite unhelpful and limiting. But Bhante also talks about, he talks in more neutral terms, actually. He talks about conditioning that we might not think of as particularly limiting or damaging or unhelpful, but is just human. So he talks about, for example, race and class and occupation and work, all of which might be quite healthy aspects of our conditioning. They're sort of human aspects. But what he's saying about the Dharma is that the Dharma is about breaking through, identifying ourselves, even by those neutral or more positive ways of being. Yeah? So, like in the park, being able to celebrate, a Kenyan runner with the same sort of enthusiasm as you might celebrate somebody from your own nationality is a sort of small breakthrough from just identifying with a particular nationality or race. Gail, you were going to say something.
I was going to say identifying with some of your job title.
Job title, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Social class.
Yeah.
I am like this.
Yeah.
I'm not happy.
Yeah.
Which I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Time.
Yeah. And it's not because the job title or the job or the class or the nationality is bad or wrong. It's not that. It's just that the degree of identification that we have can be unhelpful in that it narrows and limits us. Yeah? It narrows and limits us. And Buddhism's about breaking through all conditioning limitations. So it's not that it's bad, it's just limiting.
Our society puts us in that position in a way
yeah.
from birth, because frontiers
as a first one. So
yeah.
If there were new frontiers, we wouldn't say, oh, I'm French, you're Italian.
Yeah.
But also in school, for instance, I don't know how it works here, but certainly in France we had school for the great student, a class for the very good student, and a class for the middle level
yeah.
student, and so you dissociate yourself from others. So
yeah.
from a very young age you kind of put in that position where
yeah.
you are something, you're not something else.
Yeah. 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 And also, we're at a particular point in the evolution of our society, I mean, of our world culture. So, nation states and identification of nation states was somehow probably progress at some point. Or apart from what it then causes is conflict between nation states, yeah, over resources and territory, etc. But then we're increasingly aware that we're one global community that affects each other. Technologies, well, things like the internet have really shaped that awareness. But we haven't quite broken through, most of us, most of the time, to identify as just a human being on Earth in this kind of global way. Most of us still narrow our group that we identify with. And yet, it's obvious that the more narrow we kind of narrowly we look at the world, the more damaging that is, etc., etc. Eventually, he says that, you know, we're trying to even break through the identification of being human. And this is quite interesting. A Buddha wouldn't identify themselves as being human. They'd have transcended that identity. And I don't think he just means identifying with all life, although that might be part of it. I think he's talking about a whole different category of being, as it were. So how might we break through that sort of psychological conditioning? What sort of things help us do that?
Lifetime of effort.
Yeah, lifetime of effort, and then some. Yeah.
I think the more you meditate, the more that you see that you're not really the one personality that you might represent. So you catch yourself, you know, having a thought that, you know, kind of, you know, left-wing socialist ecologist would never have.
Yeah.
And yet that was you, you know.
Yeah, so that's you as well.
And you're doing that all the time.
Exactly.
Actually,
exactly.
You see.
That's right. That's right. So meditation starts to loosen our sense of self. And that can be a bit uncomfortable, or quite a bit uncomfortable at times. And you start to think, I thought I knew who I was, and it no longer fits. Those labels don't quite fit. Yeah.
I was also thinking sort of like you can cognitively train yourself, like what we were talking about with the work by
Byron
Katie. So you think about something that you think is true, and then sort of you find evidence for why it might not be true, and then you turn it around and sort of like make the complete opposite statement, and then find evidence for how that is true.
Yeah.
And it basically just shows you that everything's just basically like you're just everything's your mind, so you can't really say about anything that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
So, because you only have, like, your own perception. So the more you cognitively train yourself to think that way, I think the more sort of do you stop identifying with your thoughts and you can break through those schemata and conditionings.
Yeah. I think in the sort of traditional Buddhist practice, one way of doing that is by studying Buddhist texts, particularly in groups where you can, well, a bit like we're doing now, so that you can explore your views. But then what Buddhism encourages you to do is take those questions or reflections deeper, particularly by contemplating them in a meditative state. So you start to question, well, who am I? And I'm obviously not my profession. I'm obviously not just my relationships. I'm not just defined by my nationality.
I think it's because you sort of have to internalise it, because sort of like, I think you were the one that said, well, you can know something cognitively, because sort of like your whole being can know something.
That's right, and it's very different.
But I think it's also got something to do with sort of like the degree of exposure. So I think like the more you do it and the more levels you do it, like the more likely that you really sort of fully internalise it.
Yeah. I mean, that's right. It's also exposure in the sense of putting yourself in situations outside your kind of comfort zone. So going on retreat, I think, is a really good way of putting yourself outside your comfort zone, where people don't relate to you on the basis of your job, your class, your nationality, your sexuality, in a way that your immediate colleagues and friends might do. Family might do. People relate to you in a very different way, and that can be really liberating. Yeah. Well, Sangha can do that, not just on retreat. Yes, I'm just going to let me read you a little bit, and then I'm going to move on. So. Yeah, this is Bhante just using some examples. He says that we are, in fact, just a mass of psychological conditionings. We're a class conditioning plus an economic conditioning plus a religious conditioning and a national conditioning and a linguistic conditioning. We're conditioned in this way, psychologically conditioned in this way. For the most part, we think and we even feel and we certainly act in certain ways because we've been conditioned to do so. For the most part, we're no better than Pavlov's dogs. A bell rings and we react, we respond. And bells are ringing all the time. Economic bells, social bells, political bells, religious bells. The bells go on ringing and ringing, and we're responding like mad to all of these. And that we call our freedom. So he's very, in a way, strong. About this aspect of being stuck and sort of mechanised by our conditioning.
It's part of it also, this respect finding the reality, your true self. So,
yeah.
Like your meditation, things like that, there's actually this glimmers of something that you can nurture that kind of. Starts moving further and further out to the world.
Yeah.
It's a sort of a truer nature.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of.
Yeah.
It's a sort of a goal.
Yeah,
you know,
that's right.
A way, a thing to go towards.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. I think you can discover that.
You have to smash through. It's not gentle, you really have to smash through your social conditioning to even go closer.
Yeah.
A flavour of it.
Yeah. I think that's right. I think that we need to have a certain positive confidence that if we do let go or smash through all those ways that we identify ourselves, that actually we find something that's very, very positive and transcends all of those limitations, that's really, really positive, that is bright and aware and spontaneously loving and kind and metaphor and fearless and unshakable, all of those things, and energetic. Things that, in a way, are represented by images in Buddhism, like Vajrapani. What Buddhism's saying is that that is our true nature, and it's masked by all sorts of ideas that we've just picked up from our conditioning. And then we forget what we can truly be. Yeah. So I want to move on. Okay. Yeah, go on.
This is kind of more statement. I think it's really tricky, all of this, because you sort of say that you have to be fearless when we are clearly fearful people. Human nature is quite fearful, and you sort of have to transcend everything almost radically, but if you don't, how do you do that?
How do you
just
do that
in that
exactly?
place? I mean, how do you believe that, you know, by just not being fearful, everything will be?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's almost impossible to do that.
Yeah.
Because you have to believe the total opposite to what you're conditioned to believe in order to do it.
Yeah. Well, I think it is only step by step. So, fearless is an ideal. but actually this side of enlightenment, we're not going to be fearless. What we will have is fear, but we can acknowledge that fear in the way that we've been talking about, and not identify completely with it, therefore not be limited by it, and see if we can act in a way that's more courageous. And that will always be, well, no, it won't always be, but a lot of the time that will be gradual. That will be like just doing the next thing that's a little bit more in the direction that's positive. Not being limited by your views every time. But every so often, Bhante is saying that those gradual actions, those gradual incremental responses can lead to an experience that's more transformative, that feels more like we shift into another level altogether. He uses the analogy that's used in Buddhism quite a lot of breaking a rock, where you just keep practicing, you keep hitting this rock, and it's the 20th blow that breaks the rock, but the other 19 blows have been really, really necessary, but they didn't seem on the surface to do anything. And that's what he says you have to do. You have to just keep practicing. You have to keep meditating. You have to keep trying to act in a more skillful way. You have to try and keep the precepts in mind. Keep doing things like puja. Keep practicing. And a lot of the time it will feel very slow, very incremental. And then sometimes you get a bigger breakthrough. Often that happens for a lot of people on retreat, that they have a bigger breakthrough. Not all the time. We'll come on to the when and how, the when and where. But there isn't a sort of magic formula. It's more that you keep doing what you know is positive, but you keep doing it persistently.
I have a response to what you said, which is that I don't believe that human nature is necessarily fearful. I think human behaviour often is, but nature is that which we orient ourselves towards, and fear isn't. You know, we're not obligated to orient ourselves towards our
fear.
Yeah,
I
mean,
I'm
using
it as an example.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I mean it literally, but it's the sort of psychological conditioning that we find ourselves in. You can't just sort of turn a switch and
no.
Yeah.
No.
You use the word tricky.
Yeah.
Tricky is correct.
Yeah.
And that's what Buddhist practice is, isn't it? That's why we have practice. Otherwise, actually, you know, we'd just have a pill. That's what that, you know, that you could kind of take. So I'm going to move on. I'm going to move on because of time. Because there's two more breakthroughs that Bhante talks about. The next one is the rational mind. And so I'm just going to say a little bit about what he says. What he says is that the rational mind is a real evolutionary step forward. So he's not trying to dismiss the rational mind. It's led to humanity, to civilization. So reason is not to be dismissed. It's really, really important. It's led to our survival. It's allowed us to survive. So he's not knocking reason. And in fact, Bhante is very keen, although he doesn't say it in this place, for us to train our reason faculty and to learn to really use it, to think clearly and rationally. So I think reason is really, really important. And what he says in this lecture is that when it comes to directly seeing the way things are, directly apprehending reality, reason won't help us. There's a direct direct experience that even transcends emotion, actually, but reason won't touch it. In fact, if we're not prepared to transcend this reason faculty, then we're not likely to be able to have a direct glimpse. So reason's really, really useful, and we have to be able to sit light to it and be able to go beyond it. Elsewhere, what Banti talks about is the need to develop a higher faculty that transcends reason. It also transcends emotion, but it's a sort of fusion of reason and emotion, and intuition. And you could say that that faculty is shraddha, which is often translated as confidence or trust or faith. Another word that Banti has been recently using is imagination, but with a capital I to try and distinguish it from mere sort of fantasy. He's saying that this could be a word for this faculty that is a higher way of knowing, that's more than just reason, more than just intuition, more than just emotion, but somehow includes all of them. Yeah? So it's not unreasonable, it's more than reason. And that's where, again, Buddhist ritual and symbolism and myth and poetry can help us. They can point to truths that are deeper than reason can get at. And then lastly, he says that you transcend this sense of time. And this he doesn't say very much about. And I think it's very interesting. He distinguishes between organic time and clock time. Yeah? So organic time is the time that we sort of experience, if you like, in our emotional and internal world. Yeah. So say you're feeling very, very happy and expansive. Say you're on a retreat. Time seems to change and morph on a retreat. So like a 24-hour day can feel a lot longer, like a lot more happens because your experience is more intense each moment of that, certainly the waking part of that day. And at the same time, it can go really quickly. So that's just an example, or a more negative example, if we're in physical pain or some emotional pain, an hour can feel like an age. Yeah, if you're anxious, it can feel like time's just never going to move. This he talks about organic time. It's experiential time, and it's different from clock time, which always seems to move at the same rate and is linear and has a past and a present and a future. But this organic time, which is how we experience our internal world, changes depending upon our state of mind. And enlightenment, he talks about as transcending this sense of past and present and future, so that you seem to live in an eternal present. He doesn't talk about exactly what that means, but it's as if each moment has so much intensity and depth that there's another dimension that opens up. It's almost like linear time is on the horizontal, you know, moment to moment to moment to moment. Ah, that moment's now in the past, this moment to come is in the future. But moments don't exist just on the horizontal. Internally, emotionally, each moment has a quality to it. And the more aware we are, the more alive we are, the less interned we are, the less self-centered we are, the broader our perspective, the bigger or deeper each moment feels. So it's like there's another dimension to each moment, which is a vertical depth dimension. And those, if that depth dimension were infinite, then each moment might be said to be eternally present. We transcend this notion of just moving through a linear time. Okay. He doesn't give very many clues as to how you might do that. He talks about not having a watch. Goes on at great length that as how for 20 years in India he didn't used to have a watch, and now that he's come to the West, he was invited to give a lecture at the Buddhist Society, and he turned up and was about to start his lecture, and somebody looked at their watch and said, "Ah, 2 minutes late." And at the end of some sort of lecture or something, or some sort of summer school that he did, they presented him with a watch. And he said that he remembers that as a symbolic kind of chaining. This watch was on a chain to linear time. Okay, look, we're going to have to leave it there with these breakthroughs. But he's talking about those four breakthroughs of negative emotion, breaking through negative emotion, breaking through psychological conditioning, breaking through the rational mind or the limitations of the rational mind, and breaking through our sense of time. And he says that these breakthroughs can more easily happen in times of crisis, actually when things aren't going well. When things are going well in our lives, we tend to just roll on. In a time of crisis, a breakthrough can be triggered. And lastly, he ends with referring to Vajrapani. So I'm just going to read you what he says. And then we can leave it there and you can go. Or if you want to stay, some of us will just chant the Vajrapani mantra for 5 minutes. Okay, so he ends with this. And he says he wants to leave us with a picture, an image from the Tibetan tantric tradition. And it's of a wrathful deity, a wrathful Buddha. He says, what does he look like? How does he appear? And he says, first of all, it's a dark blue figure, a male figure, very, very powerfully built, with a massive torso, with enormous legs and enormous arms. Sometimes naked, sometimes draped in a tiger skin, and wearing a garland of skulls, of human skulls, and with three eyes, one in the middle of the forehead. And all these eyes, these three eyes, glare with an expression of terrible, terrific anger. And from the mouth there stick out fangs, and a red, blood-dripping tongue. And this fearful, dark figure tramples upon enemies, upon ignorance, and upon craving. And his hands, sometimes two, sometimes four, sometimes eight, sometimes 16, sometimes 32, grasp various weapons. And what does this figure, what does this form represent? This is the image of breaking through. This fearful, or this wrathful, or this terrific form represents the forces of the enlightened mind breaking, even bursting, through the thick and dark and dense darkness of ignorance and unawareness. This form, this image, represents transcendental consciousness at the point of, at the moment of, breaking through into Buddhahood. And the whole figure is surrounded by an aura of flames. And what does this aura of flames represent? Breaking through on any level, with regard to any medium, entails friction. Just as when the spacecraft re-enters the Earth's atmosphere, there is tremendous friction. And friction generates heat. And heat, when it reaches a certain point, a certain pitch of intensity, results in a conflagration, in a bursting into flames. So the wrathful Buddha, bursting through the conditioned, is therefore surrounded by an aura of flames. And these flames consume. These flames burn up the darkness. These flames consume everything conditioned. And when everything conditioned is burned up, is consumed, is broken through, then breaking through into Buddhahood is complete, is accomplished. There's then no more darkness, no more friction, no more flames, but only the shining figure of the Buddha, of a Buddha, another Buddha, seated beneath the Bodhi tree. So that's how he ends, and that's how we'll end. And yes, we've just run over a bit, so if you need to leave, just do feel free to go. But those of us that want to stay will chant the Vajrapani mantra for a few minutes.